A penny copy of the Natal Mercury led him through its small advertisements to a rooming house in Point Road, down by the docks. The room was small, dark, and smelled of those gargantuan cockroaches that infest the city, swarming up from the sewers each evening in shiny black hordes. But the rental was only a guinea a week, and he had the use of the lavatory and shower room across the small enclosed yard. That night he wrote a letter. "Dear Marian, I don't suppose you remember me. My name is Mark Anders, the same as Mark Antony. I have thought of you often since I was compelled to leave Ladyburg unexpectedly, before I had a chance to see you again." Tactfully, he avoided any mention of the research work he wanted undertaken. That could wait for the next letter. He had learned much about women recently, and he addressed the letter simply to Miss Marian, Company Registrar's Office, Ladyburg. Mark started the following morning at the City Library, walking up Smith Street to the four-storied edifice of the municipal buildings. It looked like a palace flanked by the equally imposing buildings of the Royal Hotel and the Cathedral, with the garden square neatly laid out in front of it, bright with spring blooms. He had another inspiration as he approached the librarian's desk. "I'm doing research for a book I intend writing." Immediately the grey-haired lady, who presided over the dim halls and ceiling-high racks of books, softened her severe expression. She was a book person, and book people love other book people. Mark had the key to one of the reading rooms given him, and the back copies of all the Natal newspapers going back to the time of the first British occupation were put at his disposal. There was immediately a temptation for Mark, voracious reader that he was, to lose himself in the fascination of history printed as urgent headlines, for history had been one of Mark's favourite subjects, both at Ladyburg School and at the University College. He resisted the temptation and went at once to the drawers that contained the copies of the Ladyburg Lantern and Recorder. The first copies were already yellowing with age and tore easily, so he handled them with care. The first mention of the name Courtney leapt at him in thick black headlines on one of the earliest copies from 1879. "Ladyburg Mounted Rifles Massacre at Ishlanzwana. Colonel Wait Courtney and his men cut down to a man. Blood-crazed impies on the rampage." Mark guessed that this must refer to the founder of the family in Ladyburg. After that, the name cropped up in nearly every issue. There were many Courtneys, and all of them lived in the Ladyburg district. But the first mention of Dirk Courtney came in 1900. "Ladyburg welcomes one of its favourite sons. Hero of the Anglo-Boer War returns. Colonel Sean Courtney purchases Lioncop Ranch. Ladyburg welcomes the return of one of her favourite sons after an absence of many years. There are very few of us who are not acquainted with the exploits of Colonel Sean Courtney, DSO, DCM, and all will recall the major role he played in the establishment of the prosperous gold mining industry on the Witwatersrand." A long recital of the man's deeds and reputation followed, and the report ended. "Colonel Courtney has purchased the ranch Lioncop from the Ladyburg Farmers' Bank. He intends making this his home and will plant the land to timber. Major Courtney is a widower and is accompanied by his 10-year-old son, Dirk." The ancient report shocked Mark. He had not realised that Dirk Courtney was the son of his old general, the big bearded hook-nosed man he had met that snowy night in France, the man whom he immediately respected and liked, no, more than liked, the man whose vital force and presence, together with his reputation, had roused in him an almost religious awe. His instant reaction was to wonder if the general himself was in any way involved in the murderous attack he had survived on the escarpment. And the thought disturbed him, so that he had left the library and went down to the palm-lined esplanade and found a bench overlooking the quiet, sheltered waters of the bay with the great whaleback mountain of the bluff beyond. He watched the shipping as he pondered the tangled web that was centred in Ladyburg, where the hidden spider sat. He knew that his investigations were going to take time. The reading was a slow business, and it would be days before he could expect to have a reply to his letter to Marian. Later, in his dingy room, he counted the remaining sovereigns in his money belt and knew that living in the city, they would not last him long. He needed a job. The floor manager had the beer belly and flash clothing that seemed always to go with salesmen in the motor industry. Mark answered his questions with extreme politeness and a false cheerfulness, but with despair below the surface. He had trudged the city for 5 days from one faint prospect of work to another. "Times are hard," almost every prospective employer told him at the beginning of the interview, "and we are looking for a man with experience." Mark had no time to pursue his quest at the library. Now he sat on the front edge of his chair, waiting to thank the man and say goodbye as soon as he was dismissed. But the man went on talking long after he should have closed the interview. He was talking about the salesman's commission and how it was so generous that there were plenty for two. "If you know what I mean." The man winked and fitted a cigarette into his ivory holder. "Yes, yes, of course," Mark nodded vehemently, having absolutely no idea what the man meant, but eager to please. "Of course I'd be looking after you personally, if we came to some sort of arrangement, right?" "Right," Mark agreed, and only then did he realise that the manager was soliciting a kickback off Mark's commission. He was going to get the job. "Of course, sir," he wanted to leap up and dance. "I'd like to think we were equal partners." "Good." 50% of Mark's commission was more than the manager had expected. "Start Monday, 9 o'clock sharp," he said quickly, and beamed at Mark. Mark wrung his hand gratefully, but as he was leaving the little cubicle of the office, the manager called after him. "You do have a decent suit, Anders, don't you?" "Of course," Mark lied quickly. "Well, wear it." He found a Hindu tailor at the Indian market, who ran up a grey three-piece suit overnight and charged him 32 shillings. "You wear clothes beautifully, sir, like a royal duke," the tailor told him, as he pointed Mark at the fly-blown mirror in his fitting room, standing behind him and skilfully holding a fold of surplus material at the small of Mark's back to give the front of the suit a fashionable drape. "You'll be an extremely first-class advertisement for my humble skills." "You can drive a car, of course," the manager, whose name was Dicky Lancome, asked him casually as they crossed the showroom floor to the glistening Cadillac. "Of course," Mark agreed. "Of course," Dicky agreed. "Otherwise you wouldn't have applied for the job as a car salesman, would you?" "Of course not." "Well, hop in then," Dicky invited, "and whip us around the block." Mark reeled mentally, but his tongue was quick enough to rescue him. "I prefer you to point out the special features first. I've never driven a Cadillac before." Which was for once the literal truth. He had never driven a Cadillac or any other motor vehicle before. "Rightio," Dicky agreed. And as they sped down the Marine Parade, with Dicky whistling and tipping his hat to the pretty girls on the sidewalk, Mark watched his every action with wheel and pedal avidly. Back at the showrooms in West Street, Dicky flicked casually through a bunch of forms. "If you make a sale, you fill in one of these, and make sure you get the money." Then he pulled out his watch. "God, it's late. I've got a desperately important lunch date." It was a little after 11 o'clock. "Very important client." Then he dropped his voice. "Blonde, actually. Smasher." And he winked again. "See you later." But what about prices and that sort of thing?" Mark called desperately after him. "Ach, there's a pamphlet on my desk. Gives you all that stuff. Ta-da!" And Dickie disappeared through the back door. Mark was circling the Cadillac uncertainly, utterly engrossed with the pamphlet, muttering aloud as he tried to master the operating instructions and identify the various component parts of the vehicle from the line drawing and numerated list, when there was a tap on his arm. "Excuse me, young man, but are you the salesman?" Before him stood an elderly couple, the man dressed in beautifully tailored dark cloth, a carnation in his buttonhole and a cane in one hand. "We would like a drive in the motor vehicle before we decide," said the elegant lady beside him, smiling at Mark in a motherly fashion, through the light veil that draped down over her eyes from the brimmed hat. The hat was decorated with artificial flowers, and her hair below the brim was washed silver and neatly waved. Mark felt waves of panic threaten to engulf him. He looked about desperately for an escape, but already the gentleman was handing his wife into the front seat of the Cadillac. Mark closed the doors on the couple and ducked behind the machine for one last brief perusal of the operating pamphlet. "To press the clutch pedal with left foot, engage gear lever up and left. To press accelerator pedal firmly with right foot, release clutch pedal," he muttered, stuffed the pamphlet into his pocket and hurried to the driver's seat. The gentleman sat forward in the centre of the back seat, both hands resting on the head of his cane, grave and attentive as a judge. His wife beamed kindly at Mark. "How old are you, young man?" 20, ma'am. Almost 21. Mark pressed the starter and the engine growled. So she had to raise her voice. "My," she nodded, "the same age as my own son." Mark gave her a pale and sickly grin as he silently repeated the instructions in his mind. "Accelerate firmly." The engine beat rose to a deafening bellow, and Mark clung to the driving wheel until the knuckles of both hands blanched with the pressure of his grip. "Do you live at home?" asked his passenger.
"No, ma'am,"
Mark answered and let out the clutch. The back wheels screeched like a wounded stallion, and a blue cloud blew out from behind as the entire machine seemed to rear upwards and then hurl itself, slewing wildly, towards the street doors, leaving two long black rubber smears across the polished showroom floor. Mark fought the wheel, and the Cadillac swayed and skidded, lined up with the doors at the last possible moment, and careered into the street, moving sideways like a crab. A team of horses drawing a passing coach shied out of the path of the roaring machine, and behind Mark, the elderly gentleman managed to struggle up into a sitting position again and find his cane. "Good acceleration!" Mark shouted above the roar of the engine. "Excellent!" agreed his passenger, his eyes popping in the rear-view mirror. His wife adjusted her flowered hat that had come down over her eyes and shook her head sadly. "You young boys, as soon as you leave home, you starve yourselves. I could tell you are living on your own. You're as thin as..." Mark took the intersection of Smith and Allowell at the charge, but halfway through it, a heavily laden lorry lumbered across their front, and Mark spun the wheel nimbly. The Cadillac changed direction 90 degrees and ducked into Allowell on two wheels. "Thin as a rake," said the lady, holding firmly to the door handle with one hand and with the other to her hat. "You should come up to the house one Sunday for a decent meal."
"Thank you, ma'am. That's very kind."
When Mark stopped the Cadillac against the pavement in front of the showrooms at last, his hand was shaking so feverishly that he had to make a second effort to earth the magneto. He could feel the damp of nervous sweat soaking through the jacket of his new suit, and he had not the strength to let himself out of the cab. "Incredible," said the elderly gentleman in the back seat. "What control, what mastery. I feel quite young again." "It was very nice, dear," his wife agreed. "We'll take her," her husband decided impulsively, and Mark could not believe he had heard right. He had made his first sale. "Wouldn't it be nice if this young man would come to us as a chauffeur? He is such an excellent driver."
"Oh, no, ma'am," Mark nearly panicked again. "I couldn't think of leaving my job here. Thank you all the same."
"Jolly good show, old man." Dickie Lancome folded the 2 5-pound notes that were his half share of Mark's commission on the sale of the Cadillac. "I can see a great future ahead for you."
"Oh, I don't know," Mark demurred modestly.
"A great future," Dickie predicted sagely. "But just one thing, old man. That suit," he shuddered gently. "Let me introduce you to my tailor, now that you can afford it. No offence, of course, but that looks like you're on your way to a fancy dress ball."
That evening, after close of business, Mark hurried back to the library for the first time in a week. The librarian welcomed him with a severe expression, like a disapproving schoolmarm.
"Thought we'd seen the last of you, that you'd given up."
"Oh, no, 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 by no means," Mark assured her, and again she softened and handed him the key to the reading room. Mark had mapped out a family tree for the Courtneys in his notebook, for it was confusing. There was a brother to Sean, who was also a colonel at the end of the Boer War, but also a holder of the Victoria Cross for gallantry, a distinguished family indeed. This brother, Colonel Garrick Courtney, had gradually become a noted and then a famous author of military history and of biographies of other successful soldiers, beginning with his With Roberts to Pretoria and Buller, a Fighting Soldier, and going on to Battle for the Somme and Kitchener, A Life. The books were all extensively and glowingly reviewed in the Lantern. The author had a single son, Michael Courtney. Prior to 1914, there were references to this son's business activities as managing director of the Courtney Sawmills in the Ladyburg district, and his skills as an athlete and horseman in many local meetings. Then, 1917, Ladyburg hero decorated.